You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Saul Luckman. Saul is a prolific visual artist and innovator in the field of ink painting, as well as a critically acclaimed author of fiction and nonfiction. His numerous books include the international best-selling Conscious Healing, Book 1 on the Regenetics Method, described by Nexus as revolutionary healing science, expanding the boundaries of being, and the other book is Potentiate Your DNA, a practical guide to healing and transformation with the Regenetics Method. His latest novel, Snooze, A Story of Awakening, is the riveting coming-of-age tale of one extraordinary boy's awakening to the world-changing reality of his dreams. Written with young adult and young-at-heart readers in mind, Snooze proved its literary merit by receiving an honorable mention in the 2014 Beach Book Festival Prize competition in the general fiction category. Saul is also the author of the Beginner's Luke series of serial comic novels that hilariously foreground the role of imagination in creating our individual and collective reality. You can find his works and writings on his website, www.crowrising.com, and you can find him on Facebook as well. So let's welcome Saul to the show now. Hi, Saul. How are you?
I'm great, Lance. Thanks for that introduction. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, I really loved reading Snooze. I read a lot of books from, you know, authors. Most of them are metaphysical. But this was a real treat to get to read a book that has metaphysical qualities to it, and yet it's a work of fiction with multiple layers woven into it. I mean, it works on so many different levels that it kept my interest, and I call it a page turner. And when I was a kid I was involved with Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, and I'm not going to make comparison to them, but the mystery that was created in those books is also in Snooze. And it builds a kind of excitement based on the metaphysical aspects of these of the awakening of the main character, who is just all of the characters are well drawn. They're really beautifully defined, and you just can't help but like them. And it's really an excellent book.
Well, that's really generous of you. I could just go on listening to you, you know, for the entire 55 minutes that we have.
Yes, I was afraid of that.
That's great. Well, I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad that people have seemed to like it so far. It's been getting some really good reviews on Amazon and elsewhere, and just some pretty high praise, really. And it was also an honor to receive an honorable mention in a pretty good book competition this past summer. I've submitted the book to some additional competitions, and we'll see how 2015 plays out.
Well, now, Saul, what prompted you to write Snooze? Where did this story begin to gel in your mind over a period of time, or did it all just kind of hit you in a download? Because you do so many different things, you know, from beautiful artwork to the Regenetics healing methods. We might be able to get into talking about that later. But what really inspired you to write this book?
I've written about this somewhere in my blogosphere. I've posted some information, maybe even on Amazon.com, on Snooze's page. I tell the story of how I was awoken by my young son early in January of 2013, and I have the sleeping mask that I wear, and he was in a superhero phase, and he told me I look like a superhero with my sleeping mask on.
Oh.
And I jokingly said that, yeah, I could be Snooze.
Huh.
And this was this little tiny exchange.
Wow.
Harmless enough, but it began this download, and within a matter of days, I had the character of Max in my mind. I began writing. The first several chapters flowed out of me. I shared them with my partner and my son, and they liked what they were hearing, and then I just really got into it, and I began writing it really seriously. At the time, I was on what I think of as a sort of sabbatical up in Humboldt County in California, and that's Bigfoot country, and we were also, as a family, watching Finding Bigfoot and this kind of thing. And anyway, there were lots of little pieces that began coming together. In my other work, I had been studying alternative physics, Dewey Larson, time space, reciprocal theory, David Wilcock's work, all of that, and I began incorporating these notions of a parallel reality and the power of dreams and the way dreams can access this other world into the book. As I was just downloading the material, I would take long walks on the beach and just download and download and download and download and come back and write, Hemingway in A Movable Feast. Wonderful book for writers to read. It's certainly Hemingway can have a very abrasive personality, but he has some beautiful things to say about the writing process. And he talked about how he would write in the mornings, and then he would do something else, and he would let the well fill back up. And I did a version of that. I would write, and then I would go out and walk and download, and then I would return and do something completely different. I would paint or just spend time with family or whatever, something decidedly non-literary, and let the well fill back up, and then re-engage the next day. Mm. And before I knew it, I had written, several hundred pages, and this thing was nearing completion within about 6 or 7 months, and I finished a manuscript which actually did not even go through a heck of a lot of editing, believe it or not, in about 9 months.
Mm. Wow.
That's pretty good for a 500-page book.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, I mean, I have edited books that are about that long in 2 weeks. So,
that's a fast editing pace.
Yeah,
writing,
I wouldn't recommend
it. Of course, is a different pace entirely.
Yes. But it can be done.
Well, the editing can. I'm not sure that the writing can be done. Maybe might be some exceptions. I think Jack Kerouac wrote On the Road in one long sitting, which is just almost unfathomable. That almost never happens.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Some of the things that you weave into the book are really contemporary issues for all of us. And so, for instance, in the beginning, let's say one page 178, one of the characters talks about eating organic foods only. No GMOs, no sodas, no seafood containing heavy metals, no fluoride, which means switching your toothpaste probably and drinking only reverse osmosis water, preferably in bottles free of BPA.
Well, that sounds so boring.
Oh, well, you know what? I've had guests talk for an hour about just the very subject of fluoride and of drinking distilled water or reverse osmosis. I use reverse osmosis and distilled myself, but it also has an effect on the pineal gland because there's a magnetic effect that repels the inorganic fluoride from the pineal, which is important. Otherwise, it turns to stone, and you can photograph it on an X-ray in a hospital if you can get somebody to do that for you. And you'll say, well, what's that little hard thing? What's that in my head? Well, that's just your pineal gland. They all look like that.
There are characters in Snooze who talk about decalcifying the pineal gland, you know?
Yes,
It's right in there. I was just saying that to excerpt it like that makes the book sound kind of dry and didactic. That's a piece of dialogue between characters who are somewhat at odds on these issues.
Oh, right. No, it is not dry and didactic at all. Believe me, the dialogue is really, it moves at a fast pace. You can't stop reading it, really. And so I was, another thing that I notice writers are doing these days is that they're writing very short chapters, like 2 or 3 pages. And I think that must be done because of the attention span of the reader, for one thing. And it also squares off an idea, and you can move on to the next idea. So I
think there
are
a number of reasons for that. I think the Internet has a huge impact on the way books are now written. And the fact that paragraphs are shorter online, and that pages are shorter, and it's really, really changed the way things are written. And then another real sea change happened when the Da Vinci Code came out, and it was written a little bit like that.
Yes, that was the one I was trying
to think
of.
And it was hugely successful, and that really shifted the stylistic game for a lot of writers.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next one I write is going to be like that.
Sure. You have to pack it in to these little sound bites, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And really round the chapters off. There's a kind of technique where you hook at the end. It's called a hook.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's sort of a cliffhanger concept.
Yeah.
And that's how you thread the reader's attention into the next chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So, sort of knitting. It's a weaving or a knitting that goes on.
Yes. Well, I did that in my book, Tales of a Zany Mystic, and unfortunately, I didn't stick with the marketing of it, and it's there at Amazon if anybody wants to read it, but...
You've got some nice reviews.
Yeah, I mean, it got some terrific reviews, and Barbara Hand Clow wrote a blurb for the back of the book. She loved it, and so it just never, maybe it was the timing, I don't know. But
you're so right about the marketing, especially as an indie author. You have to get behind the work and find creative ways to connect with an audience and motivate people to share it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is these days.
Yep.
There's so much competition, so much writing, and really, I know there's a lot of bad writing, but there's also a lot of good writing, and a lot of good writing by independent authors.
Oh, yes. Well, who are some of the authors that have affected you?
Oh, I've been affected by so many authors, completely inspired at different points in my life by different writers. Earlier on, I was much more in a literary, a hardcore literary mode. I liked Hemingway and Faulkner and Virginia Woolf and a lot of the really classic writers. I also love Jonathan Swift and Alexander Pope and some of the great satirical writers. I loved Henry Fielding, Tom Jones. That was really wonderful. All the picaresque writing. My first novel or series of novels, Beginner's Luke, which I'm actually in the process of bringing out in as a complete large book, where all six novels will be in one book, is totally picaresque, and it's the adventure of an imaginary lifetime.
Oh,
and it's greatly influenced by a lot of the classical picaresque writings.
Oh, nice, nice.
Including, for that matter, Don Quixote by Cervantes. So,
oh, I love
those
that.
Those were some major influences earlier on. Well, that, you know, Beginner's Luke is about, you know, well, I imagine it'll be probably, you know, put together like that. It's six books. It'll probably be close to 800 or 900 pages in book form. I mean, it's very, very large.
Huh.
So it has that baggy monster feel in some ways. and then of course, then in the metaphysical realm, I really was inspired by the Celestine Prophecy in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah.
Not from a literary perspective so much as from a conceptual perspective, and also from a publishing and indie author perspective. You know, what Redfield was able to do as an indie author, this was back in the pre-internet days, was to take this book that he really believed in, that he felt like he had downloaded, and to put it in as many hands as possible, criticism be damned, and really support it all the way into becoming a kind of industry-changing book in terms of a very non-mainstream, new age type of book that was able to become a bestseller, that was able to become a movie that was eventually sold to a major publishing house, et cetera. It was really amazing what he did with that. So that's an inspiration as well. I think that, you know, I liked, and also in the metaphysical realm, I don't know if you're familiar with Jean-Claude Coven.
Well, I guess he was my first guest on the show about 8 years ago.
Well, you know his book. Do you remember his book, How to Make Sense of Your Life When Your Life Makes No Sense?
Well, I don't think I read that one. I read Going Deeper.
Going Deeper was the title, and I just gave you the subtitle.
Oh, okay. Well, then,
How to Make Sense of Your Life When Your Life Makes No Sense.
Yeah.
That was another inspiration, in that it was also well written. That had a literary quality to it that I appreciated.
Yes, and he also pulled some information from J.J. Hertak. I went to see a conference with David Icke at Mount Shasta, and Jean-Claude Coven was there as one of the presenters, and that was one of the things he talked about.
Was Hertak's work?
I beg your pardon?
The Keys of Enoch, J.J. Hertak.
Yes, and apparently he was at Hertak's house, and he said, "Do you have time to lie down and take a nap while I run a Xerox off for you?" So he did, and so he got quite a load of esoteric information, and I think that contributed to his writing. But he also, he's a wonderful man. I mean, just so powerful, and yet sweet and kind and loving and the rest of it. And at the conference, he had Rene Champoural flown out from, I think it was Amsterdam, to give everybody an adjustment called the Atlas Prophylax. And it's supposedly the Anunnaki, this is the story, you can check it out for yourself, but when we were being manipulated in many ways, our bones were set in a certain way so that we couldn't tune into higher vibrations. And so this adjustment to the neck area only has to be done once, and then you are set. You will receive those higher vibrations. So I had it done. I thought, it can't hurt. And a friend of mine had it done, and we are still good friends, and she started taking orb pictures and has thousands of orb pictures, and then I went off and did the radio show. So, and her husband didn't get it done, and he works in a golf course.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. I know about the Atlas Prophylax work.
Yeah, and so that's something that people can do too, if you know, if they're so inclined.
I had it done. I thought it was interesting and real. There was a physical therapist friend of mine who swore that it couldn't be real, but I noticed
right.
the difference. The most obvious thing I noticed was that I could rotate my neck farther in both directions.
Right.
After
right.
doing it, and it appeared to stay in place. I've never felt like it went back out or anything like that.
I had the same experience. Other people reported mystical things and the visions and the rest of it, but that didn't happen for me, and that was all right. I had certainly had enough visions and mystical experiences on LSD many years prior to make up for a lifetime of dreaming, so I couldn't complain.
That's right. Yes. It's funny because once you've had a few of those experiences, then, you know, it can fill up the well for many, many, many years.
Oh, yes.
With imagery and just memories. I remember I did magic mushrooms when I was in college. And that was really the first experience I had, and they were really powerful. And I had a variety of just extraordinary experiences the first time I did that, and I did it a number of times, three or four times, and stuck with me my whole life. And when I got around to writing Beginner's Luke, I was still, you know, decades later, I was still drawing on that material.
Oh, it's rich material.
I know you get somebody like David Wilcock, who seems to get on every radio show that he does and talks about he's so proud of being sober for 20 years, and I'm like, you know, what's the big deal? You know, it's
exactly.
I'm a believer that the sacred plants are sacred and that they are an important piece of what it means to using them in some ways can be really important in opening up one's consciousness.
Oh,
I know,
absolutely.
I've also heard people say that things like smoking marijuana or using it blows holes in your aura. I think that's absolute bunk.
Yep, I agree.
There's a lot of evidence to suggest that the whole endocannabinoid system in our body maps directly to the cannabinoid system found in the cannabis plant.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an accident. It's like nature's gene key into what
mm-hmm.
ails us in a lot of ways, and certainly it's proven to be enormously healing in a
Absolutely.
Variety of ways. And the research, you know, has just really started because it's been such a taboo for so long. So I was really glad that, was it this year, you had D.C., of all places, legalizing marijuana after Colorado and Washington did it last year. You had D.C., was it Alaska and Oregon this year?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that was what it was. And, of course, the fascists down in Florida shut that down for medical marijuana. But anyway, live to fight another day.
Right, right. And I think that once the truth is, I think you and I are both of the idea that when the truth comes out, it's undeniable. And there have been cures for marijuana for cancer and all kinds of other illnesses. I know I've had a friend that her husband was dying of cancer, and just before he was about to leave the body, she gave him some marijuana, and it was the only thing that allowed him to take some fluids. And the fluids that she gave him were, because she's in the field of breast care and breastfeeding, she was able to obtain some mother's milk.
Colostrum?
Yes.
Mother's milk, yeah.
And
because colostrum is such an immune-boosting substance.
Yes, and I think that there are mystical properties and subtle essences in the mother's milk that you absolutely cannot get in formula. And now they're putting fluoride in formula. So they're getting the kids young so that their brains can be, halted, stunted, and of course autism, it could be the result of all those vaccinations that they get the moment they're born. You know, they're taking over.
I believe that the vaccines do play a big role in autism.
Yeah, yeah. And if there's nothing else to learn from the vaccinations, there's mercury in there. And a little child, we're not meant to have mercury. It's a toxic substance. And some people have actually been given the AIDS virus through vaccinations. So
yes.
I was one of them.
I talk about vaccinations in my nonfiction books, Lance. They laid me low. It almost killed me.
Well, I was in a hepatitis B vaccination study in San Francisco in 1982, and it was a series of three injections, and then they took blood, and I got, you know, medical blood work done for years after. They kept us on it, and the doctor let it slip out one time. He said, well, I know exactly when you seroconverted to HIV. It wasn't the first one. It was the second tube. So that means that it had to have been in the first tube, because I wasn't sexually active at the time, so it was given to me as it was in New York and San Francisco. Those two places were test sites for the World Health Organization to infect people with HIV. And
I believe you're absolutely correct.
You can look it up on the Internet. And
oh, I've studied this. I've studied this a lot. I believe what you're saying is true.
And then Bayer in Europe released all kinds of vaccinations that were for children that had the HIV virus in it, and because they didn't want to waste them. You know, they didn't want to lose the money, so they just sent it out, and of course, probably hundreds or thousands of people got infected. And so these are the things that go on that most people are unaware of. And, you know,
That's true.
We have to be more present to what's happening today, because everything isn't as it seems. And that's an understatement.
Agreed.
But, you know, and then it's
amazing when you take the, when you do take the red pill, you know, there is such an enormously steep learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people just intuitively know that. Call them the consciously I call these people the consciously unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they are blind and oblivious. It's that they're terrified of going down the rabbit hole because it is so very deep. That's really what's going on in most cases with what some people call the sheeple. They are ignorant, but I believe that it's a semi-conscious choice to be ignorant, not an unconscious choice.
Yes, a semi. And one of the things, the conclusions that I came to was that it's almost as if one cannot accept a conspiracy as being true, because if you take one, let's say chemtrails, for instance. I still hear people constantly calling chemtrails, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Those are contrails. They're vapor trails. Well, you and I know that that's not true, that there's a global engineering thing going on, and that chemicals are being poured into the air, and millions and millions and millions of gallons of this stuff. And there's blood, there's bacteria, there's metals, and they're basically terraforming everything. And there's also nanobots in the chemtrails. So we don't know what they're doing because nobody's admitting to it, and we don't know who is behind it. Okay, like we can have some pretty good ideas. So if somebody admits and does the research and says, okay, this is really happening, oh, my God, and GMO foods, oh, my God, they've done something to the plant, and it really does screw up the internal organs of the horse and the chickens. And the, you know, once you find out one thing, then it means your whole world is shattered, and everything that you believed is subject to reinterpretation and to having to think about it, because literally everything is affected by the control system of domination and control. And it's ruthless, and it won't stop until it takes over. And it's not that far away.
Well, I guess we'll have to perhaps agree to disagree a little bit. I believe it's being dismantled. I believe it's actually imploding to a large degree on itself.
Yes, I agree with you about that, but it still has teeth.
Yeah, I'm not trying to downplay it. I'm just saying that to say that it's this close to coming about is to kind of reify help manifest that reality. Let's change our language.
Yes, that's a good idea.
Let's say that it's up against very stern opposition.
Yes.
Coming from many different quarters. Let's not make it more powerful than it actually is.
Yes.
You know.
Good point.
I think we have to kind of spin things around and we have to learn that technique. And so I like to focus a lot on solutions based conversations, and also looking at what's working.
Mm-hmm.
And applying what's working to maybe what's not working.
Right, right. Because if you focus on what's wrong, then you're going to create the very thing that you're trying to avoid. So what you resist persists. But one of my friends is channels and does readings, and he said that he sees us turning the tables on them by putting a virus, you know, a kind of a love virus, into all of their operations, and that we're doing that whether we're aware of it or not, and he's doing it consciously. And so he's saying that it's not going to take long to unravel some of the things that are so tightly woven, because they have to operate in a certain way, and there's no room for random acts of kindness or random activities. And we may be programmed to a large extent, but we also have the ability to be spontaneous and random.
Right on. You know, getting into the Gnostic work, we have the epinoia, we have the imagination,
mm-hmm.
and the ability
mm-hmm.
to change realities with this powerful gift that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what Laura Walker and John Lash would call the archontically controlled elites and their minions, they don't have that kind of creativity. They're rather more robotic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their great weakness, is that they will never see the solutions that are manifesting until they're already upon them. They will never see the bushwhack, the ambush, the
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
you know, the revanche, the comeback, the, you know, whatever
mm-hmm.
word you want to put on it, until it's in their face and it's happening. You know, we're just
mm-hmm.
waiting on some kind of fabulous display of the imagination at work in a way that finally topples things. It can happen so very fast. I was always interested in things like complex systems analysis and chaos theory, and these
mm-hmm.
ideas that very small actions could have huge consequences under the right circumstances.
Yes.
And these scientists studying let's say little hills of sand, and you add one grain of sand at a time, and you keep adding it, and the hill looks exactly the same, and it is exactly the same shape, and then, you know, the millionth grain of sand later, it falls on the hill, and the whole hill changes shape.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that one grain of sand that did that. So
mm-hmm.
when is our grain of sand going to hit? Is that 2015? A lot of people think that 2015 will be a year of absolutely tremendous global change, and that some of it will be of a positive nature. I tend to think in terms of breakdown and breakthrough. I think we've been in a breakdown mode for a while. And
right.
it may be that we have to go through some more breakdown. But I think that the breakdown can translate into a major breakthrough for the people of this planet.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember doing the EST training with Werner Erhard, and that was one of the teachings that he focused on, was that on the other side of breakdown is breakthrough. And it's, sure enough, I've verified over the years that, you know, when you're in breakdown, at some point, you can speed up a breakthrough if you're aware of being in breakdown. And
well, let's just take this practically. I experience this all the time on metaphysical levels. I've had many dark nights. I've been really depressed, and I've woken up the next day with a fantastic idea. I've been rehabbing a sprained MCL. I took my body surfing too far this late fall, and so I've been kind of hobbling around and rehabbing this MCL, the ligament in my knee.
Oh.
And it's really funny because it works on a breakdown and breakthrough model itself. The ligament, when you stress it, you create a kind of beneficial inflammation if you stress it without going too far. That's the whole rehab and therapy process. You stress it, and then it kind of hurts for a day or two with this inflammation. And then it's stronger on the other side. Mm. And it happens over and over again.
Hmm.
That is the entire rehab process, as I understand it.
Hmm. Interesting.
So it seems built into our bodies, our minds, our emotions, our systems. So why wouldn't it happen on a macro scale?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, yes, of course. As above, so below.
Absolutely.
So, yes.
I mean, one of the reasons I wrote Snooze was to present a very hopeful picture of where all this could go without ignoring things like GMOs and fluoride and dental amalgams and all of these other evil things in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But you having acknowledged those things, really suggesting that we can overcome. We will overcome.
And Snooze is kind of the main character. Max is kind of a reluctant superhero. I mean, he really goes through a hard time accepting and a lot of depression because there's some major losses in his life. And you feel
right
for him, and he turns off his psychic abilities, his ability to literally be in the dream world and to bring things back. There are people who do that. It's a very real manifestation there, and there are yogis who can just, you know, manifest right out of the air. But he goes through quite a lengthy time of denial and depression and all of that, and you really feel that because who hasn't gone through that? But when he starts to decide through being empowered by his friends that he's going to get through to the other side, and he takes it on, he just transforms into a superhuman, and he's just you cheer for him. I mean, you just love his courage and his exploration and his desire to try new things and his lack of fear. You know, I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful character. And, you know,
I'm glad you like Max. I was going to ask which character you like the best.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the girl, too. What was her name?
Tuesday.
Yes, yes, yes.
Tuesday, Monday.
Yes, she was wonderful, too. I really liked her. And the roomie at the college was kind of fun, too. He kind of represented, you know, the laid-back, chill guy that, you know, is always doing the wrong thing, but it turned out that, you know, he was pretty cool and smart and psychic himself, and I just love the way it all came together, and I think all kids should be reading this in high school, And, I mean, it should be, it really should be required.
We'll be
reading.
In a very different world if all kids are reading this in high school.
Wouldn't it? Really, really. In fact, I'm going to write
that. Would
no
longer be needed.
That's right. Well, you know, I think a lot of kids in high school already know this stuff. But to see it in writing and feel it, I mean, that's really the, you know, because then you get it in your heart and in your blood and in your system, and it's circulating, and it's like you're ready to go, and you're ready to, you know, change things and do whatever it takes. And so I think when I write my Amazon review, I'm going to put that it should be in all of the high school curriculum. And we'll see what
happens.
Oh, that's
very funny. I'm imagining what that would be like, you know.
Well, I think it would be, I think it would change the world.
It's comic to me, comical to me.
Well, it's not impossible. So, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you picked up on Max's journey through his existential period where...
Oh, yes.
Had various losses. You know, I've been familiar for years with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work and the five stages of grief. And so I was able to really work that in by name and cite Kubler-Ross and the five stages and walk you through how Max went through that process dealing with his grief. And he had a lot to grieve.
He did. And a lot of people do. And that also is a model for grieving, and you know, for those kids that have lost family or loved ones, this is a model that can be instantly taken on, because it shows you this is the model how you get through it, and that's a very helpful thing to use modeling in the healing process.
Yes. Yes, it is a book in some ways about healing. That's an emotional healing, emotional and mental healing that he personally goes through. And then, of course, as he develops his powers, he learns how to heal with energy and use mystical energy to do miraculous healings.
Yes. Yeah, oh, that was really fun. You know, I've always loved superhero novels, and I watch all the Marvel movies and the DC Comics and all that. Of course, they're practically documentaries today, especially Captain America, the most recent one.
Oh, of course, yes.
But
I think it's really interesting that you mentioned the superhero aspect, because it started that way, you know, with my son coming to me and saying, you know, you could be Snooze. You could be a superhero, and I started writing this book, and I realized I was writing a superhero book, but I didn't want it to be like a Marvel comic.
Right.
I wanted
right.
it to be an actual novel, a literary novel, with a superhero who just happens to be the main character, but otherwise it's a novel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you don't find that... You don't find that kind of quality of writing and the well-crafted aspects of it. Because I mean, I'm a writer, and I read a lot of books, and I don't talk out of my hat here, but it's well-crafted, and it is a novel, and it is a well-written novel. It doesn't have any loose ends. And it comes together very nicely. It's really quite an accomplishment. I was trying to imagine how I could borrow some of your, not some of your material, but some of your style, the way that you did it, because it's very professional, and yet it's light at the same time. You did a great job on it. That's all I can say.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's really, really neat to, you know, to be in any way inspirational to another writer. So thanks for sharing that. And just to speak to what you were saying, I kept it light because I wasn't writing specifically for an adult audience.
Right, right.
And even though the book ended up being a kind of a kind of all-purpose novel where adults can read it, and young new adults and young adults and even older children, you know, can read it.
Grandparents can be reading it to their grandchildren.
The way I got out of that, my own tendency to be overly analytical, overly literary, perhaps too verbose, was to imagine that I was writing for a younger audience.
Right. That was a good idea. That was a good idea. It worked.
Well, it helped me. You know, if you ever sample any of my other work, it's not really that way. It's definitely the nonfiction is very, very nonfictiony, and the Luke material, Beginner's Luke, is extremely literary and slapstick and experimental.
Well, I definitely will work on Beginner's Luke next. And I'm curious about your Regenetics material. That came out before your fiction, right? Is that correct?
It came out after Beginner's Luke.
Okay. Okay, and then...
So I had written six books.
Wow.
Well, Beginner's Luke came out as one big book. And I wanted to move in that direction, and I submitted the book to a number of publishers. This was back, over a decade ago at this point. And I was offered a publishing contract by a very good New York publisher, a pretty mainstream publisher. And I ended up turning it down. I just have had a problem giving away my stuff to somebody who may or may not do what I want to with.
That's right. That's right.
And I've often said that, you know, publishing, mainstream publishing, is sort of an act of disempowerment in some ways. And
yes.
Anyway, and it was after that, as I was bringing out Luke, that I found myself working on the first Regenetics book, which was Conscious Healing.
And then you have a book out called Potentiate Your DNA. Now, I know that was a big movement before 2012. Everybody was having their DNA altered and going to, potentiate their DNA. How is this book different from the DNA movement that we have, that we saw in the New Age movement?
Well, you know, you might get around to checking that out at some point for yourself and seeing how it's different. It's really hard to do it justice in an interview if you haven't really read the material.
Right.
But it's not about 2012. I was keenly aware of 2012 and had hoped for larger scale changes like a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
But the work itself is not in any way dependent on that. I was sick. I was really, really sick back after my own hepatitis B and yellow fever vaccines, and I had something that had a lot of affinities to AIDS and was dying.
Wow.
And this work came through on a spiritual level, and it cured me.
Wow.
And then I began sharing it with other people, and a lot of extraordinary results came from that. And then I wrote Conscious Healing, and that was translated into Turkish and was a bestseller in a couple of different markets and received some accolades. And then, but it wasn't a how-to book. It was an introduction to the concept of what it might mean to activate DNA using sound and light, or sound and intention, as I phrased it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Potentiate Your DNA was book two on the Regenetics Method, in which I taught the reader how to do the potentiation for themselves.
Oh, great. Great.
So you re-potentiate your DNA and you just do it. You can do this work, or at least the first phase of this work, for yourself. So you're using sound, using vowel sounds combined with a thought process of vowels. So you're using what I think of as sound and intention, sound and light, to stimulate a kind of self-healing reset in DNA. That's a kind of It's a kind of metagenetic, I call it metagenetic, beyond genetics. Mm-hmm. But it involves epigenetic factors, I believe, where you're looking at the possibility of shifting genetic markers epigenetically to help the body cleanse and restore itself. It also works mentally, emotionally, and even spiritually.
Wow. Well, I know Bruce Lipton has talked about that quite a bit, and even John Lamb Lash has talked about our DNA being a copy of a copy, and that we need to have the ability to regenerate the original. And so I think that we're reaching a point now where we're about to discover or rediscover our own inner transformational abilities. And, you know, books like yours are, you know, certainly going to help bring that all forth. And I think we're really, really close. It's almost like the 100th monkey theory.
Yes. Well, I know that Lash also says that we will know that we are becoming the next iteration of the Anthropos 11, when we begin to have supernatural abilities to do mystical things and spontaneous healing and distance healing and all of these things. And I'm living proof of that to some degree. I'm not saying I'm the next Anthropos, but I'm very much in process, as I believe a lot of people are. And regenetics is an example of this movement towards what Dr. Larry Dossey would call non-local medicine. And it goes beyond just epigenetics, where we think happy thoughts and we use positive affirmations and we have certain beliefs that help us change our genetic activity, into the non-local realm, where the genetic blueprints exist, where we can consciously interface with our own blueprint. And this is over in time space. Potentiate your DNA is all about time space, just like snooze, only from a different angle. And so we can go over into the blueprint using sound, modify the blueprint, and the blueprint will flow back into our reality through our DNA and help us heal.
I love it. I love it. That makes so much sense. Well, now I'm going to have to read more of your books.
Yeah, maybe we'll have another chat one of these days.
Oh, we will. I can already tell we're going to have at least one more or two more, because you're so much fun to talk to. And we didn't get to talk about your artwork, which is so beautiful, and I wanted to mention that. But people can go to your website, crowrising.com, and see your original paintings. And you are just a multifaceted person that works on so many different levels. I mean, you're just... you're really quite amazing, you know.
Well,
and,
thank you. I'm glad you like my painting.
I do, and you know, it's funny because I think I noticed you first on Facebook when I've been following the Oracle Report for quite a few years, and I had Laura Walker on the show a few years back, and I've never had Andrew on, but I had Laura on, and I loved the Oracle Report, and then here was Saul Lookman. And so it's funny how things come together like that. And Lamb Lash, I've had him on the show. And his book is quite excellent, too.
Not in his image, yes.
Yes, it's really a wonderful read. I mean, it will...
Oh, I like that book a lot.
I do, too. And another one is Michael Tellinger's book, Slave Species of God.
Yes, I've followed Tellinger's work for a long time.
Yeah,
and I like much of what he has to say. You know, it's always a picking and choosing.
Right.
There's always elements that really work for you in anyone's work, and then other elements that maybe don't resonate quite as much.
Exactly, and what you and I know is that we don't have to make them wrong. We just simply take what it's like a smorgasbord. You take what you like and eat a lot of it, and hopefully you don't get sick, and leave the liver on the on the tray for someone else.
No, you got to eat the liver. It's full of nutrients. It's nature's multivitamin.
Oh, well, okay. Well, maybe I'll try a piece. Well, you know, we're almost out of time. I could talk to you for another hour easily, But before we go, would you mention where your website is, what you're doing, and where you can be found, and anything that you'd like to promote before we sign off?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My main website for my art and writing is crowrising.com. Crow like the bird, rising, crowrising.com. There's a lot of free material there. Beginner's Luke, the first of the Beginner's Luke novels is free. You can read a very lengthy excerpt, something like 80 pages of snooze. There's a lot of art that you can view for free. There are something like 14 or 15 videos that are very humorous videos that you can watch and that sort of thing. The Regenetics work is at phoenixregenetics.org, phoenixregenetics.org. And there's a free book on there, too. Conscious Healing is there. It's for free. And there's a fairly decent download of chapters from Potentiate Your DNA available. And on Phoenix Regenetics, you can sign up for DNA Monthly, which is, wow, it's entering its 11th year right now. I've been publishing this e-zine for 11 years. And in the archives, there's articles by David Wilcock and Bruce Lipton and Elizabeth Sartoris and Jeremy Narby and, you know, Richard Allen Miller, all kinds of people.
Mm.
So you can sign up for a free subscription, or you can just read it online for free, the current issue in the archives. And then you can get to my art by searching for me on Fine Art America or fineartamerica.com or going to the gallery page at crowrising.com, and there's lots of links to where my art is available.
Wonderful. And, of course, you're on Facebook.
I'm on Facebook. I do all of those time-consuming things that we do these days.
Right.
A lot of times I feel like just, you know, putting the kibosh on that and going into hermit mode and getting more work done, but maybe that's not what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, maybe not. I go through the same phases, so. Well, Saul, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I just love your book, Snooze. Everybody should go out and buy it, and I look forward to talking to you again, and I want to thank you so much for coming onto the show tonight, and we'll welcome you back in the near future.
Thank you, Lance. It was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, me too. All right. Well, good night, Saul, and good night, listeners.